So this is about moral imagination, as you saw on the door when you walked in. There are a couple kind of big names. If you were to Google moral imagination, there's probably two main names that you would see right off the bat. First step on my Google search was Russell Kirk. And he, this is just the only book I had available to me at the moment to bring. This is actually some of his fiction, it's ghost stories. But primarily, what I've heard of him is more essays and more philosophical books, but I'm told this is really, really good. Now, the man that wrote the intro to this is named Vigen Guroian, who I know visited Chapel of the Cross not too long back, and he's another name. He wrote, he actually wrote a book called something like Nurturing the Souls of Our Children, or Nurturing, does anyone remember the title? But it's specifically about books, stories, kinds of things that will nurture the moral imagination in children. This is called Rallying the Really Human Things, and it's going to be a little more theoretical rather than real practical titles and books and things like that. You're welcome to look at them. I'll keep them up here. This is actually just one I had to return to somebody who lives in the area. So I thought I'd bring it, and it looks, I think it's a really good series, Brian Jacques. And of course, this. So. Really, and then it degenerates a bit after. Okay. I know a lot of our students over the years have read the Brian Jacques books, but anyway, I thought I'd start off with those. So, have any of you heard the term moral imagination? I know if you've been to my talk, you would have, but if you've heard Vigen Guroian or if you've been in any other, you know, a lot of circles are talking about this lately. The term, actually, I kind of heard bandied around over the years because a lady at our school was really interested in it. And that's, actually, I got one of those books from her, I brought it. And she would just collect works from Touchstone, works from all kinds of journals, books on the moral imagination. Never really thought about the term, but it actually comes from Edmund Burke. And it comes from his work, Reflections on the Revolution in France. So a friend of his wrote to him, kind of, I think a little optimistically, say, so what do you think of our great new revolution, all this reason and life, and tell me what you think. And he kind of tactfully started off, well, you know, around the bush a little bit. But by well into the work, he's condemning it roundly. He was not in favor of the French Revolution. So he actually, one of the terms that he uses is this term moral imagination. So I'll read you, I think that's your first quote actually on the handout. Here's what he says, one of the things he says. But now that you've had this revolution, all is to be changed. All the pleasing illusions which made power gentle and obedience liberal, which harmonized the different shades of life, and which, by a bland assimilation, incorporated into politics the sentiments which beautify and soften private society, are to be dissolved by this new conquering empire of light and reason. All the decent drapery of life is to be rudely torn off. All the superadded ideas furnished from the wardrobe of a moral imagination, which the heart owns and the understanding ratifies as necessary to cover the defects of our naked, shivering nature and to raise it to dignity in our own estimation, are to be exploded as a ridiculous, absurd, and antiquated fashion. On this scheme of things, a king is but a man, a queen is but a woman is but an animal not of the highest order. So if you know anything about the French Revolution, which I'm sure you do, this, a king is but a man, that's one of the huge themes of rallying cries. And, you know, why do we need a king? He's just a guy. And you hear this today all the time, you know. In the West, particularly in the North, you frequently hear, if you try to call someone Mr. So-and-so or Sir, they'll say, I'm just a guy, you don't have to call me that. It kind of embarrasses them because they don't think of themselves with that kind of dignity. So this term moral imagination, Burke is somewhat of a storehouse. So he's talking about it as a wardrobe, a place that you take beautiful things out of so that you can use them. And he says that out of this wardrobe comes the decent drapery of life, the sentiments which beautify and soften private society. All these ideas, they come from the wardrobe or the trunk or the repository, which is a moral imagination. But now, of course, everyone's rejecting this. We see a, and we'll get in more, of course, to the details of it, but we see this same idea, not by the same term, but we see this in Lewis's writing, and particularly in The Abolition of Man. He's coming at it somewhat aslant, but I think it's a real similar idea. And his big quote, does anyone know what's kind of the big term we always hear from that book, Abolition of Man? It's a short little... that's it. He's always talking, he talks about men without chests. What does that mean? It basically means this is the middle part of man, we might say. There's the mind and the rational part of man, and then there's the appetites, what tastes good or feels good. And then there's the middle part, there's the heart, or the gut, the imagination, the emotions. And he's saying that we've developed people that they can be rational, and they definitely have appetites, but they don't have any soul, we might say. They don't have any heart. And that's a problem. Men without chests, or women. It's not, it's people, kids, humans. Why is this a problem? One of the things that I'm going to assert today is that it's very, very difficult or impossible to develop virtue, whether in yourself or in children, in those that you're teaching, without a moral imagination. And of course, it's not the only thing we have toward virtue. We just don't imagine. We have certain fixed points, right? We have, as it were, we could say it's like connecting the dots. Let's say that there's this connect the dots picture in your coloring book when you're a kid. And maybe it's a tree. And there's all these dots. And, they give the general kind of outline and idea of what it is that you're supposed to be connecting. And maybe they give you, here and there, they give you a specific line so that you get onto the right track, maybe. Well, let's just say, let's imagine that those dots are like the law, or like rules, the Ten Commandments at least. And then all the other directives that we have. The idea is not, the idea, first of all, is not the dots aren't really the ultimate point, are they? It's not, we're not supposed to stop there. They're pointing us somewhere else, and even Scripture talks like that. It talks about the law as a tutor, which brings us to Christ. So the dots are important. This isn't to downplay them. But they are not sufficient in themselves. But they're good, but they're not enough on their own. So hopefully, as you become a more skilled artist in your coloring book days, you'd be able to... I better use green, not orange. You'd be able to see that, this is supposed to be a tree. Okay, well, I'm going to hit all those dots, but I'm going to also make it look really beautiful. I'm not just going to do simple straight lines the whole time. That wouldn't be the very best picture. So, okay, I'm going to get them all, but I'm going to also add the curves, and maybe I'll even do some shading if I'm really fancy. So you do eventually draw... Hello. You do eventually draw maybe a good tree, and you hit all those dots, but it's also a lovely picture. So that kind of extended analogy is what this in the middle that fills it all in, that's largely done skillfully by having a moral imagination. You start off with, of course, the big block letters, the big dots, do these things. But hopefully you come to where you can fill it in beautifully, and that's what we're trying to do with this moral imagination. So we're trying to fill in the dots between the law, between the laws. Okay, so it's necessary, is what I'm saying, for developing virtue. Well, why? Why is it? Let's examine that a little bit more. Let's look at that next quote that I have there. This is from Reinhold Niebuhr. You may be able to compel people to maintain certain minimum standards by stressing duty, but the highest moral and spiritual achievements depend not on a push, but a pull. People must be charmed into righteousness. Stanley Hauerwas says this, what is lacking is not a better moral calculus of what acts Christians should or should not do, but an enlivening of the imagination by images that do justice to the central symbol of our faith. So we don't need to add ever more and smaller and more detailed dots. We need to know what it is that we're aiming for, what it is we're drawing, and be able to do it skillfully by pictures, by seeing goodness and beauty and virtue. And eventually then we can imitate it much better. In what specific ways would I say that a moral imagination contributes to virtue, and then we'll talk later about about the development of it. It's fairly simple. Okay, so particularly the big one that I was going to talk about is wisdom. Wisdom is something Aristotle called the mother of the virtues. So it's kind of the source. It's where they come from. It's from wisdom. And wisdom, there's several different ways that we speak of wisdom. One is practical wisdom, and that's kind of more what we're getting towards now. There is also the wisdom that contemplates things and can see connections. You know, there is what's a little bit more of a mental or rational wisdom, but then there's the wisdom that can do skillfully, right? And can act skillfully. And the moral imagination is what one of the things that will help us to do this. Will help us to see in a given situation what would be the best thing to do. There's a story that was going around recently. It's a true story. It's kind of sad. It ends okay, but it's kind of sad. There was a man who took his little boy, I think he was six, to a ball game. This happened 5, 6, 7 years ago, and he took him up to the concession stand to get something to drink for both of them, and he bought himself maybe a beer. And he bought lemonade for his son in a bottle. But what it really was hard lemonade, Mike's hard lemonade. But he didn't know it. He thought it was just lemonade, and, you know, it cost $7, but this is a ball game, okay. So the security guard sees this little six-year-old contentedly drinking his hard lemonade and, you know, is alarmed, rightly so, if he's going to drink that whole thing, and takes him away, rushes him, whisks him off to the doctor to be examined, and he was okay. But then they took the dad into custody. He had to spend some time in jail. They finally, the boy got put into foster care. The dad couldn't return home where the son was living for 2 weeks. Just all these bad things happened from this mistake that he made. It was an honest mistake. As it turned out, everybody along the way, that security guard, the hospital personnel, the police officers that got involved, the judge that heard his case, they all knew. They all believed him that, yeah, this was an honest mistake. But I'm sorry, I have to follow the law. I have to follow the policy. And, you know, I understand that that happens in public life. But they all knew this is really a bad decision, but following all the rules still yielded a bad decision. So there's a place where wisdom will know when to set aside the rules. And sometimes that's wisdom. You know, we don't want to just profligately throw aside the rules just because. But there are times when that's the best decision. We have the example in the Old Testament of David eating the showbread, right? He's not condemned for it. That's used as an example of appropriateness. Like, David knew how to do that. David knew what was more important. But then we also have examples in the Bible of people strictly following the law, and Christ kind of rebuking them nonetheless, because they didn't understand the greater matters, the justice and things like that. But they tithed all their mint and cumin. But they were supposed to do that. That's the thing you have to remember. He said, don't not do that, but you need to do this too. Do them both. So wisdom is an acquiring of knowledge how to do the best thing in a given situation when there's no rule. There's no calculus that tells you exactly what to do. It can be kind of a scary place to do that. Here's the phrase I wanted to find in my last one, but we call it Eskimos. The Inuit say that wisdom is being able to see what needs doing and then to do it well without being told what to do. And Aristotle calls this, if you're interested, phronesis. It's a kind of wisdom that's knowing what to do. Okay. Forward to hope. This is an interesting one. I read a quote. I didn't put it in your quotes, but I read a quote that I could find it. One of the problems with those who are mentally ill, and maybe those particularly who struggle with depression, is a failure of their imagination. Their imagination is not working well. And that's a big statement that would take a lot of unpacking, and I'm not meaning to be simplistic, that that's the only thing wrong, but that's a big part of it. And this man is a counselor and psychiatrist, and that's what he came to. That there's a big part of imagination that nourishes our hope, nourishes us in hope. And I'm going to read from this, the place where I heard this quote, about a man who's Roman Catholic, and he has struggled with depression on and off throughout his life. And he's honest about it. But he says, some of the things that have helped him in grappling with that were the stories that his parents would read to him when he was little, before he ever had a problem with this darkness that he encountered. Sorry for the delay, just a second. It's called Deep Calls to Deep by Joseph Prever. He says that his family was a literary family. My father and mother both read to us, each from their favorites. From my mother, we got Lewis and Salinger and MacDonald before we were old enough for any of them. From my father, we got Tolkien and Homer, for whom one is never too young or too old. And he talks about the images that were put into his mind that he learned from this reading, and how his father would do voices for all the, you know, even the Nazgul in the Lord of the Rings, and his sister would wake up afraid at night because she could so easily imagine the hissing and the Nazgul. So he tells about his mom reading The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, which is not typically really kind of kid-friendly. It's really severe, dark. But, you know, he says the part when the mariner bites his arm and sucks the blood because they're so thirsty, and it's so grim. And he would ask, "You mean really that's what he did?" "Yep, that's what he did." And they kept walking along the poem. And she's called A Nightmare Life and Death. The Nightmare Life and Death was she, this apparition that comes in and wins the, you know, wins the game against him, and now he is taken over by life and death. And his mom explains why that's even worse than death. If death had won, that would be bad enough, but ooh, life and death. And he says that's one of the closest images we might have for damnation, is always alive but always dead. He says, well, is it safe to expose children to this darkness, all these dark stories? And he says, well, I think it is, or as safe as any real poetry can be. Poetry is no tame lion. At that age, I had no categories in my mind for real darkness, and so the darkness couldn't get in to do me damage. But the image stayed, which meant that when the reality showed up years later, I was not defenseless. He says that his mom told them it's important, it's worthwhile to memorize poetry and scripture, even if you don't understand what you're memorizing. I had a question in the first session about education specifically and how do we nurture this good moral imagination in children. And one of the ways is memorize. Get this stuff in your head. Scripture, of course, but good poetry and worthwhile stories. The idea was to populate our minds with these words and phrases. The valley of the shadow of death. Wine and milk without money and without cost. As the deer pants for running streams. Deep calls to deep. So that when they were needed, they'd come more readily to hand. She was right. Now, when I flail out into the darkness, I can come back with, thy waves and thy billows have all gone over me. Or I can grin at a bleak December and shout, cold and chill, bless the Lord. Or go out stargazing in rural New Hampshire and whisper, look at all the fire folk sitting in the air. He goes on, I can still remember the moment when the simple phrase, born again, suddenly became real for the first time in my life. Suddenly meant something palpable. It was like a flood of molten metal. Would the experience have been the same without the phrase to express it? Where might that metal have overflowed without a vessel to contain it? Or would it simply have been lost? For that matter, which came first, the experience or the phrase? Did the phrase only express what I felt, or did it, like a kind of sacrament, help to bring into being that which it signified? Depression was my first experience, he says, with life and death. But for every human, disorientation and loss and heartbreak and unrequited affection are simply, sooner or later, par for the course. And these things are very bad. But without poetry and scripture, they would be intolerable. Psalm 130, the book of Job, Gerard Manley Hopkins, T.S. Eliot, not only were they my companions in grief and rejoicing, but they even taught me how to grieve and rejoice. I won't even comment too much on it because I think he puts it so well. I'll leave it right there. So that's one way, I think, in which good literature and a well-stocked moral imagination can be amazing tools in life against darkness and dreariness. But on a kind of a lighter note, the other side of it, we have this quote, and this is also speaking of hope, we have this quote from The Lord of the Rings, and it's where Sam and Frodo are on the trail, and it's difficult, and it's hard, and they're taking a bit of a rest. And Sam starts to ponder, I wonder what kind of story we're in right now. And he starts to ponder the good stories that he knew growing up. And he says this. The brave things in the old tales and songs, Mr. Frodo, adventures as I used to call them, I used to think they were things the wonderful folk in the stories went out and looked for because they wanted them, because they were exciting and life was a bit dull, and kind of sport, as you might say. But that's not the way of it with the tales that really mattered, or the ones that stay in the mind. Folks seem to have been just landed in them, usually. Their paths were laid that way, as you put it. But I expect they had lots of chances like us of turning back, only they didn't. And if they had, we shouldn't know because they'd have been forgotten. We hear about those as just went on, and not all to good ends, mind you. At least not to what folk inside a story and not outside it call a good end. You know, coming home and finding things all right, though not quite the same, like old Mr. Bilbo. But those aren't always the best tales to hear, though they may be the best tales to get landed in. I wonder what sort of tale we've fallen into. So this ability in some way to see yourself from outside as a character in a story and to think, I wonder what kind of character I am, what kind of story is it, and if I am that character, what should I do? You know, that he has a certain kind of, you know, down-to-earth, trudging in the mud kind of hope, knowing that, well, it might not be the best story to be in, but I bet it'll be a good story to tell. And I really love that part. So hope is a big part here. I want to talk a little bit about nobility, and I'm not going to try to offer you a really great definition of nobility. I don't really have it on hand, I'm sorry. But let me give you a contrast, two contrasts here. Remember when King David was running from Saul, and this is the man pursuing his life, trying to kill him, and he won't even, you know, his conscience smites him because he cuts off part of Saul's robe as kind of a little joke. You know, he's kind of messing with him. He's not even going to kill him. And later he's like, I shouldn't have done that. That is very noble. He understands. He understands the unseen things. I didn't talk explicitly about what imagination is, but I've been using it in the sense of you can see what's in some sense unseen, or you know, you can see what's not immediately obvious or immediately visible. And it definitely was not obvious that Saul was a king. He's not acting like a king. That's one of the big contrasts. If you go through 1 and 2 Samuel, is Saul and David. Saul and David, and Saul fails over and over. David's gonna succeed. But he does not have the idea a king is but a man at all. Robespierre, French Revolution anti-hero, infamous. Robespierre is the one that pushed to kill Louis XVI and his wife, the royal family. A lot of people in the French Revolution said, well, let's just get rid of the kingship, but we'll let them live on their little country estate, no problem. And he said, no, we should kill them. So I just, the kind of nobility that, and I guess I'm attributing to David a good moral imagination. I suppose it could just be that he stuck strictly to the rules. But I think it's more than that. I think that he had a sense of what God has made this. I'm going to see it like that, even when it doesn't look like that at all. I'm going to see Saul as kingly, even though he doesn't act kingly. Also, in Cupid and Psyche. Psyche, It's not pointed out maybe as strongly, but again and again, she is so queenly. It even uses that adjective several times, queenly. She's very gentle, even when Orwell is urging her to, you know, what's going to ruin all of her happiness. She barely gets angry. She controls herself and she answers, you know, you didn't have to threaten to kill me. You're the person that I love, and I would have gone with that. You know, she just is a very noble character, and just the image of that is good for our imagination. It doesn't even have to be commented on. It doesn't have to be pointed out. Just seeing that is good. And later we can hopefully ask ourselves, okay, did I act like that? Can I act like that? So wisdom generally, which is large, and I'll come back, remind me, wonder, that's a good one. I'm going to actually write that down below so I don't forget. Fourth, mercy. That's a big place where, because that's a big place that our moral imagination will help us. Remember, we have Jesus at the house of Simon, and he comes in and he's eating, and that sinner from the town comes in, and she has the costly oil, and she breaks it on his head, and she weeps on his feet enough to wash them, apparently, and wipes them with her hair and kisses his feet. Amazing. Well, all that Simon sees, we're told, is the sinful woman is in my house, who is my only guest, making a ruckus. You know, all he can think of is that. He's not seeing what's going on there. Now, and this is going to lead into here, it's stories. What does Jesus do? He doesn't say, Simon, you are being prideful, or you are being condemnatory. He doesn't address it head on. He says, hey, Simon, let me tell you a story. There are these two men, and they had a master, and one owed the master a lot of money, and one owed him, you know, maybe $10, just a little. But he forgave them both. Which one do you think will love him more? Well, okay, Simon plays along at least. He says, the one that he forgave more. You're right. And then he just compares him to the woman. I don't remember from the story. He doesn't ever address him directly saying, you have failed in this way. He just tells a story and he points out images. Look what this lady did. Look what you didn't do. So it's interesting both that he doesn't understand mercy because he's so concerned with the detail. Not that you shouldn't be concerned with the details, but they overtake his mercy and his vision. And Christ tells him a story. He does that frequently. Let me tell you this parable. Secondly, a lot of you might be familiar with the character of Shylock in The Merchant of Venice. He had a deal that if this other guy didn't pay him back, he got to take, this is really macabre, he got to take a pound of flesh from his heart. I don't know why he would want that. He's already a bad, grim character. So Shylock is the character that has this bond, this contract. Well, it turns out the man's ships didn't do as well as he wanted to on the seas. He doesn't have the money. He can't pay Shylock back. Well, Shylock comes in and says, I have this contract. I have this bond. I will take a pound of your flesh. Well, everyone urges Shylock, no, you don't have to do that. Be merciful. The quality of mercy speech. Be merciful. No, I will have my bond. Well, finally, he ends up the tragic character because they turn it on him and say, well, if you're so concerned with details, you can take a pound of flesh, but not a drop of blood. And if you take a drop of blood, your life is forfeit. So he loses everything. Because he can't see past this contract. You can let it go. You can let the contract go and have mercy on the guy. So Shylock ends very badly without any mercy and without any imagination. Anne Shirley would be very displeased. No imagination whatsoever. So those are just a couple. I'm sure there's more, but wisdom and hope, that was the one that surprised me most in doing this research, and ability and mercy. Okay, so let's talk a bit more now. Do you have any questions? I'll pause a minute. Comments? I'm going to try to keep it moving along. What is it that helps us to develop this? And I'm going to focus mainly on the literature of it, but there was one story I did read recently. This is a story, but it was about a person telling about what had happened in real life. The people that we encounter in real life also will help us to build a moral imagination. This is one reason I love, and I think it's important to tell children stories from your own life. Because I think that then they see you as a character in a story, and it's about five times the influence to hear a story of God's faithfulness from my mom, or someone that I know close up, as to hear it from the Bible, as important as that is, because it's a real person walking and breathing here with me, and I can see their story a little bit. So it's not to downplay it, but I am talking about literature here. So parables are a big way. Christ is always telling parables. Fables, fairy tales, other Bible stories besides fables, those are kind of the basic ones. Those are what kids should hear from before they even know what you're talking about. You want your memory and your imagination stocked with these things. So part of the imagination is the storehouse. It's a place where we have images kind of stored. It's also a way of seeing. So it's both. It's partly the shape of your imagination is something we're concerned about, and also what it contains. And the two things feed off of one another. But we don't just stop with stories. This is not to be sort of anti-intellectual. We do go on to more complexity as we get older. And probably after fairy tales and fiction stories, it is important to read the lives of real people. Biography, biographical writing is very important. And Russell Kirk is, again, the man that you would go to find all of this. He writes extensively on it, and he even puts together kind of four categories, ending with actual philosophy. When you're older, he says when you're about 19 or 20, go on to philosophy. The school that I went to, you used to take philosophy in your second year, and this was a liberal arts college, and they realized, it might not be good to give really young guys all this philosophy right off the bat. It's just not good for them, so you had to wait till your fourth year, so you had a little bit more experience, and then you could do philosophy. So he puts that near the end, but here are the four categories. You start off with fantasy, and that's this area here generally, even if some of them are true. Fantasy. And one of the reasons he says that to start with fantasy is that out of these early tales of wonder come a sense of awe and the beginning of philosophy. And just that putting together a sense of awe and philosophy, I think, is worthwhile to think about that. That philosophy is not just about facts, 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 right? Was anybody in Father Fuss's yesterday? Or you might be, he uses this illustration a lot, and I use it a lot, so... But you guys might be familiar with Professor Gradgrind from Dickens' Hard Times. And all he's concerned about is facts. The way to train children is to give them nothing but nonfiction. But as it turns out, the little girl in the classroom that her father actually trains horses, she knows way more about horses than the little boy that memorized the facts from the dictionary. But this professor is so blinded that he thinks that the dictionary answer is the ultimate final answer. And you who've been with horses all your life, you don't actually know anything. Because he's not concerned with that kind of knowing. So there's this idea of a sense of awe that will be helpful to us in later philosophy. So the Brothers Grimm, Lang's collection of fairy tales, Anderson's fairy tales, The Arabian Nights, Howard Pyle, and everything else I've got there. On to second, narrative history and biography. Russell Kirk, I think, was a remarkable man because when he was 6 or 7, he says, my grandfather and I would talk of the character of Richard II and of Puritan domestic life and the ferocity of Assyrians. I think he was a pretty precocious child. So Dickens, A History of England, Hawthorne's Grandfather's Chair, History of the World by Ridpath, H.G. Wells' Outline of History, and eventually Herodotus, Xenophon, Thucydides, Polybius, Tacitus, and all the rest. Plutarch's Lives were very important. These are biographies. When you're a little older, reflective prose, and poetic fiction. Hugo, Dickens, Twain, Walter Scott, Shakespeare. He actually says, there's an interesting quote, this is kind of provocative, I think it was Chesterton, but I may be mistaken. Chesterton says that a story with no wicked characters is a very wicked story. So just, don't fall into the trap, which a lot of modern educators have fallen into, now it's kind of gone the other way, but that if there's a wicked character in a story, then children shouldn't read it. Quite the contrary. Although I've had fiction that students have wanted to read that seem to have nothing but wicked characters, and you don't want that either. But he said, such miscellaneous browsing in the realm of fiction rarely does mischief. When I was 11 or 12, I was much influenced by Twain's Mysterious Stranger, an atheist tract disguised as a romance of medieval Austria. So it was Twain at his atheistic best. And he said, it didn't really harm me, but it did make me inquire after first causes. So it did set me to thinking, but he said that didn't harm him. So that's reflective prose and poetic fiction, and four, philosophy and theology. For the crown of normative literary studies, we turn about the age of 19 or 20 to abstraction and generalization. So much more abstract. And he does say chastened by logic against Emerson et al. The romantics and the transcendentalists didn't have as much use for logic. They kind of wanted to escape the restrictions of logic. And we'll talk about them in a minute with the idyllic imagination. That would be Rousseau, his favorite place to live, the idyllic imagination. So it's simply not true, says Kirk, that one impulse from a vernal wood may teach you more of man, of more evil and of good, of moral evil and of good than all the sages can. Mm-mm. It's not from vegetal nature that one acquires knowledge of human passions and longings. So he just kind of knocks that out. So those are kind of the four categories that he goes through. Somebody asked me, well, what makes it good? What makes it good for the moral imagination? I don't have one particular answer that sums it all up, but for sure it's going to be something that either has lasted the test of time, because typically something that resonates with our humanity at a deep level is going to last over time. A lot of the fiction that my students read now is not going to last. It's just nonsense. Some of it might. I actually don't mind Harry Potter too much, but I'm on the way. A lot of it's not going to last. The stuff that you want to read is either very old or, you know, having lasted, or someone that's been informed by that kind of reading. That's going to be quality. So that's kind of an earmark, but not, it doesn't maybe tell exactly why it's good. But it's going to resonate with our humanity at a very deep and important level. Comments or questions? I have one more kind of category. What happens if you don't have a greatly, you know, particularly if you're resistant? Not if maybe it's deficient. If, you know, there are certain books I did not read till college that I'd be loath to admit that I didn't read in childhood. So it's not like you have to start off like Russell Kirk at the age of 7 discussing Thucydides. But what happens if you reject it, or you've been severely deficient in it? What's typically gonna jump in? Did you have a question? Okay. What he says is two things typically will arise. You're going to have the idyllic imagination, and then often that will slide into the diabolic imagination. You might jump straight into the diabolic. But first, the idyllic imagination is what you think of, two kind of groups in history that you will think of maybe immediately. That's my one. Two people you'll think of immediately are the Romantics. You know, the kind of Rousseau, after the French Revolution, Romantics, reacting against all the really violent rationalism of the French Revolution, and then their great-grandchildren, the 1960s and 70s hippies, were the reincarnation of the Romantics, really. There's a lot there. There was another colony in America. Has anybody heard of the Oneida colony, or Oneida, in New York? And they were kind of an 60s, 70s, 80s commune, complete with free love. I mean, everything. They were right down to all that. So the idyllic imagination wants to push against customs, laws, strictures, and just be free. I just want to sing. thank you. That would be the idyllic imagination. The problem with it, okay, one other image that I hope this won't step on any toes, but it is Thomas Kincaid. Is the artist of the idyllic imagination in our time. He didn't want any hard lines, nothing kind of sharp, nothing too dark. He actually was not a very happy man. If you know anything about the end of his life, that was not his actual world. What he painted is not what he lived. But it's what he desired, but I don't think he knew how to go about getting it. So typically you'll get bored with the idyllic imagination, at least to boredom or ennui, and then just to have something of interest, many people will turn to the diabolic, and that is where movies, a lot of literature, that's where our popular entertainment culture is today, is it firmly entrenched. There's some of the idyllic, the idyllic would be like the typical romantic comedy, and everything just kind of ends perfectly well and fine. The diabolic is almost everything else. It's, you know, gratuitous violence, displays of chaos. Never thought about that, but just all the chaos and blowing things up, and I don't love it, so maybe I'm not fair to speak about it, but and then not to mention all the, you know, pornographic images that are everywhere. That's all part of the diabolic imagination. And Russell Kirk drew the connection between specifically pornography and the lack of a good moral imagination for several reasons. One being that, yeah, if a king is just a man and a queen is just a woman and a woman's just an animal, well, what's the problem? Yeah. It's nothing. A woman is nothing. Or me, myself, who's involved in this, it doesn't matter. So first of all, because of that. And second, because, yeah, if you're bored, if you've never been given anything that actually sparks your mind, if your teachers thought that Dick and Jane and Elsie Dinsmore were good fiction, is anyone familiar with Elsie Dinsmore? It's very moralistic tales of the late Victorian age, and the little girl always gets into these scrapes, and she always comports herself perfectly, and is very moral. And she's very obviously moral, and she would tell you so. It's so boring. And yeah, it's teaching good things, but very poorly. If you're bored with that, you're going to go looking for anything interesting, even if it's really dark. And it's unfortunate, but that's what a lot of kids, that's been their option, is they're not given anything really solid to chew on. So the next best thing, they think, is sex and violence. You know, gratuitous. Now, there's a lot of classic literature that has a lot of that in it, but it's very different, and that's going to be beyond the scope of my talk, so... comments though? Questions?
You said that having the moral imagination, it's able to imagine a better place, like the guy that had depression. You're able to imagine a better, land, a better place.
Yeah.
So where do you draw the line between imagining a better place and as in Thomas Kincaid's situation, he was ideal about it? I think about him contained. He's from Flashville. I've been in many times. I've seen tons of them.
Yeah.
Where do you draw the line?
I think, so the question is, when is it escapism? And, you know, when is the moral imagination actually, is it wrong to try to imagine a better place to be in? Is that kind of what you're asking?
Well, I mean, the first part of your talk, to me, it seems like you're saying that that's kind of what you do. You imagine a better situation.
Partly. I think that's part of it, but that's actually, particularly with that story of Samwise, he's actually not running away from what he's in. He's not trying to escape it. He is trying to, I think, maybe interpret it. And maybe that's what a moral imagination can do, is you can take what is, when you need to, take what's unpleasant and you interpret it well. You know how to incorporate it. He asked, what kind of story am I in? I don't want to be in it right now. You know, he even said, some people just get landed in these stories, and he knew how to take it in and make it into a good story. You know, a good story has darkness. And I think that accepting that is a submissive thing to do under God's hand, and then to say, well, now that I'm in this story, what should I do? Whereas actually the idyllic imagination, it doesn't seem like it because it's so pleasant seeming. It's actually rebellious. It's very rebellious against the real world, and you know the world as God made it, because you reject all the things that are dark or painful or difficult or ugly at the first, you know, that we don't like. Whereas I think a proper moral imagination is used to seeing those things. That doesn't shock you so much. I mean, it might be shocking to our sensibilities of who we are because we don't like to undergo those bad things, but we know that, these things do happen. I've seen them in stories all the time. I've seen them around. I've heard stories. You know, my parents have told me about bad things that have happened and how they got through it. And that's where your moral imagination begins to be enlightened, to know that I can put this into a good setting. And yeah, I don't mean just kind of blind optimism. Does that answer your question? Maybe? So the difference is not just focusing on the good to the ignoring of the bad, it's learning to take it all and know what to do with it.
So you think McCain was just ignoring the road just going from A to B?
Particularly his later stuff. Actually, I saw the Kincaid, you were talking about Thomas Kincaid. His earlier stuff is not quite so much like that. There's more mud in the streets. There's more, a little bit less, it's a little more chaotic. His later stuff became, I think, very idyllic, a product of the idyllic imagination. I'm hesitant to say exactly what I suspect, because I thought I heard it once about him, but you might, maybe that's just gossip mongering. But I think in several ways he was not a happy person, and I wonder how much he slid into that third category of the diabolic.
If he was that kind of unhappy, it probably went back to not having the hope or even the seed of hope.
Interesting.
I don't know. But it's like people who are characters in a story who do not have the hope of the redemption.
Right.
And don't have any of the Christian background teaching. Don't know that there's any hope.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the characters who do, then can take these awful things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of Mothers Against Private.
Yes.
Those horrible things that happen when the parents take something that bad and create a good consequence. It does not negate the bad.
Nope, exactly.
But it transforms it. It transfigures it into something.
And I think one of the things that makes us resentful of evil, aside from just being human and simple, but I think having this kind of imagination, evil is this terrible intrusion that I should not have to deal with. Because that is how the world ought to be, idyllic. Right? And hopefully we can get a little shaken out of it and be like, you know, no, this is more close to the world, and I've lived in this world, at least in fiction, and I can function in it a little bit more, rather than rebel against it. And that's is really very pernicious. This kind of imagination, it looks very sweet and nice, and I more and more don't like it. Comment.
In the context of making ethical decisions, mm-hmm. like wrong, is there any difference between your usage of the term moral imagination and the term conscience?
Interesting. That's a good point. So the question is if there's any difference between the term, distinction between the term moral imagination and conscience. I would have to think about that more carefully, but I think it seems to me that conscience is still more referring to kind of the big issues of the law. Maybe not. I think a well-trained conscience will at least know how the big laws, the big E on the I chart, how those things work down into the details, hopefully. But that takes a lot of training, you know, for your conscience to make those connections, maybe for you to make those connections. I think that if nothing else, the moral imagination would certainly inform your conscience. Question?
We speak sometimes of the Western tradition, the legal tradition.
Oh, yeah.
And the human scripture. Maybe what you're after is the moral imagination is more what you have explored as the wisdom tradition of scripture. Mm-hmm. There's a legal tradition. It would be interesting to explore the Venn diagram between those two, the conscience and the moral imagination.
Yes, so the wisdom tradition and the legal tradition. And I would definitely put the moral imagination in the wisdom tradition. Yeah. We're out of time. Thank you very much.